Hi, this is Nico. You're listening to My Dad or Fall, also known as the White Rabbit and Jamie's Security on the one and only Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Buckle up and enjoy.
A little echo on that, huh?
I know. I thought for a second maybe you re-recorded it. You were trying to get it a little bit more BPM.
That was interesting. I'm not sure what happened there.
I feel like I should have glow sticks.
Yeah.
Patrick beat you to that. I told him next time we do this. Well, you are actually sitting in the dark, Adam.
I know. I was going to say, he's already set up for it. He just needs a couple strobe lights going on there. And he's good to go.
All right. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, folks. Welcome down the Security Rabbit Hole to another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. I am Raph. To that way on the end is James. Again,
good day, sir.
Good day. And in the middle, we have returning man from cave. Adam, how are you?
From bunker in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, Adam Myers is bunkering.
The power's already gone out.
Well, before we started recording, I was like, "Hey, Adam, you got to turn on the light because you like it's just a dark silhouette." Like this is one of those hacker in a hoodie moments.
Yeah, yeah, like the witness from like the nicotine stuff back in the day.
Yes, that's right.
The voice changer and the shadow and just.
That's right. We got to do an episode like that, and just to be funny.
That was my bad doing a voice changer.
Yeah, that was bad. All right. Well, it's been a minute since you've been on last, Adam. I think it was like late last year, towards autumn last year, and we were talking about, how are things? Are things getting better? Are things getting worse? And at that time, it felt like it was kind of stupidity status quo, right? Like it was just things were bad, but they're just sort of continuing to be bad. And since then, we've had a number of companies get ransomed again. And then some, we've got extortion happening quite a bit. We've got all kinds of crazy things. What are you seeing? Because you've got probably the broadest lens of the guests that I've had in terms of visibility into this madness.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting worse. We have we had our Global Threat Report come out back in February. Yeah. And two of the things that were in that, I think that were relevant to this conversation. The first is that we saw a 76% increase in the amount of victims on data leak sites.
Oh.
One of the trends that's been occurring for the last couple of years is that in addition to encrypting the files, many threat actors will also steal data and then potentially threaten to disclose it if they're not paid. We've heard some, uses what people refer to as double ransom, where they'll have one price to unlock the files and another to not have them splashed on the internet. Some threat actors have moved towards pure data extortion. They don't even bother to encrypt the files, and some do just to make it visible, to kind of bring attention to it and create a disruption. And then that becomes kind of the, oh, hey, by the way, we're going to leak all your sensitive data. So that's up, and there's been a lot more data leak activity. And the other thing that we had in our Global Threat Report, and we have our what we call eCrime Index, or ECX for any assembly nerds out there. And this is, we kind of tried to come up with our own version of like the Dow Jones Industrial Average, but for the cyber kind of criminal world. And so we took 34 different observables, ransom payments, number of ransoms, a whole host of things that we track. And we created this kind of index of that. And we track that real time. You could go to adversary.crowdstrike.com and it's freely available. You could kind of see what that index looks like. But that was up across the entire year. Now, when you look at ransomware, though, then the average ransom demand was down something like 27%. And you might look at that and think, well, it is getting better. And we can start to, you know, hope for the best. But the reality is that ransomware has become more of a volume play, where the ransom demand itself may have gone down a little bit, but the number of incidents that we're seeing is going up. And so they're willing to accept less money more times is basically how that kind of comes down.
Do you track, because we talked about this a few times, Raf, on some other episodes. You know, you talked about the different, like they ransom it, then they start stealing it. And then we did see a few articles that seemed kind of one-off of, there was the example where they were trying to extort by saying, hey, we're going to start swatting your, you know, cancer patients. We're going to start, you know, filing SEC violations on your behalf. Like, are we seeing more than that? I know we saw a couple in the stories, but is that something that's trending, or it was just kind of a obscure thing that somebody like, oh, this would be cool to do, but nobody's really starting to do that?
We may see more of it. We certainly have observed plenty of 8K filings over the last couple of months as a result of cyber incidents at victims. The, you know, them threatening to disclose it to the SEC, I think that happened one time that I'm aware of where they actually did it. That is kind of that continuous iteration by those threat actors, right? When GDPR became a thing, we saw more and more threat actors referencing GDPR in data extortion demands. And I think that is kind of on par with these adversaries looking to maximize the pain on the victim.
Yeah.
Because if they can maximize the pain, they know that they're more likely to pay and pay quicker and with less complaint.
Well, not so, just the pain, right? Though just that fear of something worse is coming along. I mean, I remember my sister going through some, you know, somebody tried to do like one of those, you know, eBay scams or whatever, you know, and they, like, as you say, no, I'm not going to do this transaction, right? It starts escalating into, oh, well, you know, we're going to send the FBI and the DHS and the CIA. And, you know, they got images of people being arrested, like all in this email.
Yeah.
So, you know, just that fear factor of, oh man, I better do this.
I'd say that's more consumer targeting. We don't really see that on the corporate side. We have seen, though, increase of these threat actors actually harassing executives and their families of the victims in order to try to compel them to pay.
That is I don't know how else to say that, but that's a shit thing to do. Like, I mean, effective, I think.
Yeah, otherwise they're really nice people that, you know, you wouldn't expect that kind of behavior from.
That's okay. Fair point. That's fair.
Just shutting down hospitals and school districts.
And yeah. You know, there used to be honor, I'd say honor among thieves, but there used to be like at least some code that would say, hey, like that's a hospital. People die there if you mess with that, right? Like financial institutions were a target. Retail was a target because nobody died. Yeah.
When was that? Because the first ransomware, you know, that really made it into the you know, we had SamSam or Samas was kind of the original enterprise ransomware. But quickly following their activity, one of the first ones was BitPamer. And the first target that really made it into the headlines was the National Health Service in the UK. So,
all right, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there never was.
It's just your positive thing, thinking, Raf.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though, about ransomware is that what you want to do is you want to find an organization or a target that has some sort of operational imperative. They have to be up and running. Hospitals, medical centers, doctors' offices have to be up and running. And the concern that they will have for their patients if they can't dispense medicine or run diagnostics or schedule surgeries, that's real, right? And there's huge impact from that. Other targets they've gone after with similar effect, manufacturing, right? When you are in the manufacturing business, if you're down because of a ransomware encryption activity, you can start to calculate that downtime in dollars and cents. We can't produce widgets or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so that calculus is a factor that these threat actors are looking for because they know you're doing that math. And at some point, the amount of cost to you for downtime is going to be greater than the ransom demand.
And the visibility is so much different there, right? I mean, you think about, I mean, I remember, I don't know, a couple months ago going into Sam's looking for a certain cleaning product that you could not find, right? And you ask the person like, hey, like, do you have any more of this? And they're like, yeah, no, like they're way behind on production due to, you know, an incident that happens, right? And they were referencing cyber incident that occurred that showed down manufacturing, you know, and, you know, the consumer, while not directly part of it, feels that, you know, that one time you're going looking for that, it's not there, you know, which then helps also, I guess, put that additional pressure on the organization. You know, it wasn't just the internal side of things that we had to deal with.
And they did a number of iterations of that, right? You had the Colonial Pipeline incident, which was the first time I think that people really cared about ransomware because, oh, I can't get gas for my F-150. Like, how am I going to drive around? So
yeah,
that was, you know, I think part of the thing that kind of brought that concern mainstream. And then you see the White House talking about it. And then the second thing that made it mainstream was going after a big meat company, right?
Like, yeah,
take away my gas and my meat, I'm a vote for somebody else, right? I'm gonna be real mad. I need my meat and my gas. And so you know, they've kind of done those things. But you know, some of the other targets they've gone after are state and local government, school districts, right? I remember a couple of years ago going into, I think it was 2019, going into the school year in August timeframe, we started seeing increased ransomware activity targeting state and local governments because and school districts, because they knew if they took those school districts offline, there's a cascading effect there, right? You can't go to work if you have to stay home with your kids.
Yeah.
And this is before COVID and all the remote work stuff. So it was really effective to do that. And state and local school districts, they don't typically have the, you know, cream of the crop cyber defense teams and tools because they're operating on a budget oftentimes, or they just don't have the expertise that's available to a major corporate entity. And so they're trying to, you know, they've got the cybersecurity guy that also runs the VOIP PBX and also runs all of the, you know, school district applications and everything else. And they get overwhelmed very quickly.
Yep.
And when you have all the parents calling up and they're like, what are you doing? Why isn't school open? You know, I've got stuff to do, and yelling at the school district, they're going to pay because they've got to get back up and running.
And you think about like a big school district. I mean, say here, right, in Jacksonville, like it's a pretty big school district. We got a lot of schools, you know, spread out across. Imagine if you took the same organization and said, hey, look, you've got 250 locations around town. How big would their cyber team be, or even just their technology team be, compared to probably what the school board's running with, you know, maybe one person that knows cyber and, you know, three or four sys. You know, like it's nowhere near in comparison to your point of what an organization like that bank that has 50 branches would have a completely different outlook than a system of that size.
Right. But at the end of the day, they're all paying the same green money. So they don't really, or green Bitcoins,
right.
So don't really care, you know, what the impact is. And that's the thing, like you have to recognize that the ecosystem of ransomware is kind of worth talking about as well, because you have ransomware as a service. Ransomware as a service is like a SaaS business where you're running the crypto, you're running the backend infrastructure, and in many cases, they're running the negotiation with the victim. And then you've got these so-called pen testers, who are anybody with some degree of computer skills that can tie together the front end of getting into an organization, deploying that ransomware, and then they kind of go hands off. And the ransomware as a service takes 20 to 30% off the top. It's a rev share model. And they're going to, and oftentimes when you see law enforcement has seized some of the funds, it's almost always the 80% or the 70% of the funds that would have gone to the pen tester, to the individual that's using that ransomware as a service, because the ransomware as a service peeled off their part and they're not going to put it on a server that's accessible to law enforcement.
You know, we've been talking about verticalization of crime, e-crime, for a while. That just what you just told me kind of reminded me that this continues to evolve, because you've got – I just did a webinar yesterday where we talked about like the three types of – I think you and I actually originally talked about this, three roughly types of threat actors, right? You've got – we call them Bob, like the hobbyist, the person that's just going to try to break into stuff that's easy, low-hanging fruit. Right, kind of the low risk, low reward thing. Like if it's moderately well secured, they're not going to try it. There's the criminal actor, which, you know, has a financial motivation. But if as a target, if you are hardened enough, it's financially disincentivized for them to go try to hit you. But more on that in a second. And then you've got your state sponsored threat actor, which means your name's on a whiteboard and you're screwed, right? You've got a hitman with your name on a piece of paper, like bob and weave, duck and cover, don't leave the house kind of thing. But that middle one, I think, is evolving because we talk about the risk profile. These were groups that were after this is a business for them, right? They don't want to expose the business. They don't want to take unnecessary risks. They're going to go after big payouts with soft targets, like you said, that need to be operationally there and available, that if they're down, there's a problem, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like some of that has gotten because of the verticalization, the people on the front end of it are pushed most of that initial risk. Is that, am I right in that?
I wouldn't call it verticalization. I'd call it an ecosystem, right?
Okay.
It's almost like paint by numbers. So if you are a moderately sophisticated 20-something-year-old in Russia and you want to make some money and you know that there's money to be made, you can find a ransomware as a service where you have to kind of demonstrate some bona fides and credibility, and you have to do a certain amount of business with that ransomware as a service. You might leverage a cryptor and a loader service to be able to get malware to be undetectable by things like antivirus or security tools. And you're going to use maybe a spammer to send out email links for something, right? So you've got a number of choices and a number of services that you can leverage. And at CrowdStrike, we actually put out a blog post probably back in 2016 where we talked about what we called the e-crime kill chain.
Yeah. And
we look at e-crime differently than those targeted intrusion actors, because what happens with e-crime is that there is this whole ecosystem where somebody could be providing a service where they don't actually involve themselves specifically in a crime, right? But their tool might be used in that crime. And so, you know, you have to look at all of these things. And this is why we created that e-crime index, because if you look at all of these things as an ecosystem, as a economy, then you can start to measure the health of that economy. And some of the things that we've seen, for example, right, I mentioned that the ransom demands are down in terms of volume, number, but that the activity is up in volume. We see the cost of a cryptor going up. We see the cost of a loader going up. Info stealers, one of the things I think that is worth talking about is the way that these threat actors have evolved. EDR has largely made conducting these operations like walking into an airport with a water bottle, right? They're going to catch you most of the time. And so, you know, if you look back a year and a half ago, all of these incidents were involved, you know, with some sort of, you know, Excel document with a macro, malicious macro that wrote Cobalt Strike for post exploitation. And then they would use Mimikatz to dump creds and move laterally and go after their targets for encryption. As EDR over the last couple of years has really become fairly endemic across all of the environments, it's kind of the standard for most environments that you have an EDR solution. That's made life difficult for these threat actors. Bringing a binary, a malicious binary into an enterprise is very much like trying to bring that water bottle into the airport. And so the threat actors have pivoted. They've moved. They take this. I'm sure I've used this on this podcast before, but the adversary is very much, I think of that Bruce Lee quote about be like water, right? Water takes the path of
least that you've used before.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of my favorites. But the adversaries have done that here in the ransomware domain, because what they're doing is rather than try to get past that EDR, they're going after a new thing, which is the identity. And so if they can compromise the username and password of an interesting target or somebody within the environment, then they can start off by logging in legitimately. And if they get into a virtual desktop environment, then they can go just open up something like Microsoft Edge and start browsing around on legitimate servers inside the environment. And they look like a real user. And that's very difficult to see on an EDR even with a pretty advanced threat hunting team. And this is why identity protection has become so important over the last year, because, you know, looking at, you know, Raf's logging in, you know, typically from New Jersey with a Android device, and today is coming in from Oxford with a different Android device. Well, why is that, right? And identity protection can actually identify that as an anomaly, flag it. We can contain Raf's identity so he can't touch anything until we get him on a voice call or a video call, ideally, and say, hey, show me your badge and what are you doing? Are you in England? Are you on a different device? What's happening? And if he's like, I don't know what you're talking about, then I'm like, all right, we need to reset his creds. We need to reprovision everything because something happened. Yeah. And that's how a lot of these things are unfolding. And if you look at a group like Scattered Spider, which has been in the news quite a bit over the last couple of weeks and months, that's what they're doing. They're old school hacking. They're calling up the help desk, which is effectively metriced on how quickly do you resolve a call and was there a secondary or tertiary callback. And if they can kind of use that against the organization, they call up and they're like, hey, this is Raf. My email's not working. And the help desk person's like, okay, well, let me ask a few questions. And, you know, it's open source, right? Effectively to find out where you work and where you live and maybe even who your manager is. And then at that point, they're like, okay, so I don't see your account's logged out. Did you forget your password? And they're like, yeah, I forgot my password. And I'm like, all right, I could help you with that. And so I've heard hundreds of hours of these social engineering calls at this point, and you could hear the relief in both the threat actor and the help desk person's voice when they figure out the right combination of things to reset the password. And then, you know, sometimes multi-factor authentication is the only thing to stop that from getting worse. And you'll hear the help desk person say, okay, anything else I could help you with? And I'm like, oh yeah, I got a new phone and I can't log into my multi-factor auth now. And like,
oh.
it happens every day. And so this is kind of, you know, this is your that's what you're trying to do is your front line of defense. There's no firewall or EDR or anything that's going to stop that. Yeah. This is where identity is the next kind of critical ground. And one of the things that we're really focused on at CrowdStrike is what we call cross-domain threat hunting, because you can't just look at that identity stack in isolation. You have to look at that as it pertains to, did they compromise an identity and then use an Azure run command to deploy a remote monitoring and management tool, right? So now you're hunting in the identity data for any anomalies around the authentication. And then you're also looking at the Azure control plane data. And then you're also looking at the endpoint data to see what got deployed. So you really need to be able to hunt across identity, enterprise, and cloud.
How is it different between, you do the identity management, right? And I see, oh, you logged in here, but it's different than everything you had. We're going to flag that. Now I need to get, like, that's a help desk call, what feels like of, hey, you need to verify who you are because of what you're doing, versus the initial help desk call of, hey, I forgot my password, I switched my device. Like, how does one work better than the other to verify that? Couldn't they just still do the same thing on that?
It should.
You know, like the constraint, right. is it that issue that they're not doing like that video call, show me your badge on the help desk call?
I think that's the direction it's going. They need to be able to do that. And they need to be able to say, okay, well, you know, I mean, look, if you call your internet service provider and say, hey, there's a problem with the connection and I could see the cable hanging. And they're like, all right, well, I'm going to send you a link. Click on that link and we're going to open up a video so I could see what you're seeing. Right. If they can do that to diagnose an internet outage, then surely the help desk of a company can say, okay, like, we're going to have to go to Zoom. I'm going to shoot you a link on your phone that's registered with our system, right? You're in GAL, the global address list, that we're going to send you a Zoom link via text message and join that link. And then I need to see your employee ID card or badge or something, and I'll reset your password. It means more work. It means it's going to have like probably some slower response time. It might mean a lower NPS score, you know, because somebody got hassled to have to get on a Zoom call and their hair wasn't did. But at the end of the day, like that's the direction it needs to go.
Is that actually a good thing though? Like if we, the corralling of not being able to just drop binaries and that and kind of pushing it to, I guess what I call would be like the social engineering side, which obviously is difficult to deal with sometimes. But if there is a solution, like we've corralled off of the digital side of things, we're forcing you into a human interaction.
And then we're forcing them to a deepfake. Right.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. Is like the deepfake technology is good enough to fool us on you know things President Obama didn't say. I don't know, man.
I can go switch right now. Like I don't have it completely set up, right? But on my Linux system here with a GPU, I can switch my face to be somebody else. Like I could take Ralph's TikTok and
good news is I don't have TikTok.
Whatever.
His Instagram. Take his Instagram.
Look at how many videos there are on down the security rabbit hole, right? So yeah, I can pull all of that. I can train it all on Ralph's face from like a couple of minutes or a couple of hours, depending on how much I want to train the model. And I can switch myself to Ralph. I'm going to do that now.
Adam, there's only room enough in this world for one of me. I'm sorry. That's just how that is.
Next episode. I'm expecting that's going to happen. Episode that you're on, Adam, I'm hoping I'm staring at – I'm not hoping. I'm expecting to see two Ralphs I'm staring at.
that is a level of scale. But this is kind of – but that's the escalation, right? But Adam, we've been talking about identity, I don't know, since 2015, at least 10 years. I've heard identity is the next security perimeter. Identity is the security perimeter, and like so, all we did was stand up better IAM tools that then got breached digitally.
Here's what happened there, right? Like we basically said, all right, slap multi-factor off on it back during the pandemic, right? Because you know when you were saying that in 2015, 2016, that was all well and good in theory, but people still had to go into the office, right? You still had all of these controls. When the pandemic hit, we kind of moved 2023's digital strategy up to 2020, and we hit the gas. And it was kind of like YOLO. Let's just throw multi-factor authorization
That's
on
exactly what it was.
And now what we find is that multi-factor is defeatable. It can be defeated through social engineering. It can be defeated through fatigue attacks. There's lots of ways to do session cookie capture with things like Evilgenix 2 and some of those tools. So you've got all, I think there's even Evilgenix 3 now. So like you could do that session cookie capture and borrow the identity. And we've seen a massive influx in info stealers where they are stealing identities. Increasingly because of what we've done with the remote work options, we say, okay, hey, James, you can log in from your kid's machine if you want to today from home. And you don't know if, you know, like my son is into modding Minecraft, right? So if you get the wrong ModCraft mine and it has an info stealer and now you log into your work account from that, they get your username, they get your password. And now the only thing that's stopping that from becoming the next breach is multi-factor auth. And if there's not a good solution in place to look for the anomalous login attempts and seeing that, hey, wait a minute, Adam was logged in here and now he's logging in here and he's got a different, and he failed multi-factor auth. That's an anomaly. We need to, rigorously pursue that in order to figure out what's going on.
I think it's interesting because if we started treating and attacking identity like we did the endpoint, right? So if we can profile you, we can figure out what you normally do. If you step outside that norm, we challenge you. You fail the challenge, we quarantine you, and we kind of, segment you, put you off in your own little space. Like that's, we could, I don't think we could do that with the identity 10, 5 years ago, could we? Like in an automated way?
No, that's the thing, right? Like, so we implemented multi-factor authentication as a solution during the pandemic. And then you saw this whole trend of zero trust everything.
Yeah.
Zero trust is a methodology though, right? I mean, there's products that enable it and help you with it. But at the end of the day, zero trust is a methodology. And so what we need to do is we need to have identity protection in place, which is able to enforce that policy that we've set up, right? And so that is, most organizations have not invested in identity protection, which is effectively the EDR wrapped around the identity and authentication mechanism.
So let me just pivot for a second because we're running out of time. One of the things that that caught my attention about when you guys published that global threat report, we talked about this. It's got to be a couple of years ago. You were talking about how long it takes the different nation states on average to break out. Like if they land here, how long it takes them. I saw a metric. I think it was like 2 minutes or something, which like my head exploded because we were talking hours and days.
So the average breakout time, and what you're talking about is what we call the breakout time. That's how long takes for an adversary once they get access to move to another system, to move laterally. Because now you're not, you know, if you stop them when they first get access, that's the end of it. If you're chasing them through the enterprise, now, you know, now it's a problem. And that's a lot more resource intensive, and you got to go find them and find everything that they touched and clean it all up. The average breakout time in 2022 was 84 minutes. The average breakout time in 2023 was 62 minutes. So the adversary got 22 minutes faster inside of a year. Now, the fastest breakout time we saw in 2022 was 7 minutes and some seconds. I think it was 7 minutes, 15 or 18 seconds or something like that. The fastest breakout time we saw in 2023 was 2 minutes and 7 seconds.
That's what it was, 2 minutes and 7 seconds. I read that and went, oh man, now, good luck.
Now, here's the thing that's really interesting. We did a breakdown of one of the incidents that we looked at, and I think we calculated it's 53 minutes, 46 seconds. Okay. The first 39 minutes of that activity was password spraying. So if you take password spraying, getting that initial access out of it, that was a, quick math, I think it was like a 15 minute or 25 minute. I don't know. I forgot the numbers, whatever. It was under 20 minutes, let's say, of actual intrusion activity that occurred, with the preponderance of that time being spent getting access, doing that password spraying. So if that isn't a, oh crap, I need to go buy some sort of identity protection and like take this seriously.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. Yeah. I think that's the interesting thing for me is we look at the trends and how long it takes an adversary. And there's still a lot of, I like the focus that you guys continue to have on the, can you stop them after that initial jump, right? When they first break in, because you've got some time and they have to be detected. But if you can catch them there, then effectively the cleanup is way less, right? And that's not really because, it's not somebody breaks into your house and you shoot them dead at the front door. Cleanup on aisle three. Right. But if you have to like chase them through the house and you've got a gun battle going on with, while your family's trying to sleep and stuff like that, like that's a whole different thing. Right. More damage, more threat.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that the take a look at what happened to Microsoft last summer. Right. Or no, not last summer. That was the hack before this most recent one. So the most recent hack at Microsoft was the Russian SVR Cozy Bear comes Exchange. In. Via no, not Exchange. They come in via a legacy tenant.
Oh, that's right.
Where they forgot to turn on multi-factor authentication. Now,
yeah, I read that.
The fact that they were able to then wormhole into the corporate core and see the executive and legal and cybersecurity team's emails is another issue entirely. Let's say,
yeah.
The fact that they were able to come in through that one account that didn't have multi-factor authentication enabled. This is identity is the current and, for the short term, I'd say for certain, the battleground. And if you don't have adequate defenses around the identity stack and have the ability to hunt across that identity stack, then you are playing with both arms tied behind your back.
Yeah. That just brings up the pictures of the Black Knight in Monty Python, both arms off, still trying to kick, not very successful. Yeah. What's that?
It's just a flesh wound.
Listen, so one last question, because we gotta go. But one last thought, and we really haven't addressed this directly before. But how much of the infrastructure that is being attacked that you guys are seeing is laptops, desktops, physical infrastructure versus like AWS, Azure, GCP, and the like.
We saw a 70% increase in cloud attacks last year. So
that's significant.
Yeah. And 2 or 3 years ago, if you had asked me what the threats of the cloud are, I would have told you, oh, it's coin miners, right? But that's not the case. We have seen more and more intrusions that are targeting, and you know, Azure is one of the most prolific that's out there. There's so many organizations that use Azure that I'll just kind of talk about that one. Threat actors who understand not just, you know, oftentimes like we call them cloud conscious, right? So if they land on a Linux box, let's say, they know to run LinPs to see, oh, are we on a cloud box or are we on a enterprise box, right? They understand that and they can then take appropriate action. We've seen threat actors that can pivot from being in the enterprise up into the cloud. And then they use the cloud for persistence, right? So they'll create new accounts in Microsoft Azure. They'll use things, and I keep picking on Microsoft Azure here, and I'm only doing it because I'm most familiar with it at this point. But they'll use something like an Azure Run command to deploy a remote monitoring and management tool. That speaks also to what we're seeing on the endpoint side being so difficult that they're moving away from things like Cobalt Strike and some of the traditional post-exploitation tools, and they're using things like AnyDesk and FleetDeck, some of these remote monitoring and management tools, TeamViewer, et cetera, because they know that those things are less obvious to somebody that's threat hunting. They're less obvious because they might be in legitimate use in some of
those dual use tools.
Yeah. So, I mean, the adversary has evolved over the last year in a very meaningful way. And I think, you know, these are, you know, it's the cloud, it's the identity, it's the social engineering, right? They've changed. If a year ago we had the same conversation, we would have been talking about any of this, right? So the adversary is iterating because whenever it's like squeezing the balloon, when you squeeze the balloon, it's going to go somewhere. And that's what the adversary is doing.
All right. Well, this has been enlightening and fun. Thanks, Adam.
Sure thing. I'll also do kids parties if you need. So.
Yeah. Although maybe you turn the lights on when you do kids parties. Huh? Yeah.
Or just make sure you put Raph's face on.
There you go.
That's so much more creepy, James. Why?
I know.
Why? Hey, how often do you guys remind people? How often do you guys publish those threat reports?
That's an annual thing. We'll probably do a hunting report come out this summer. But we are we're constantly putting things out on our blog and on Reddit. We have a pretty healthy Reddit user base, about 20,000 people. So we like to share hunting queries and things that you can get access to play along at home and see what you can find.
Yeah. What's the one last final question? What's the most interesting thing that you've seen in the last couple of months that's made you go, huh? That's creative. That you can talk about?
I would say that, you know, Scattered Spider is continuously pushing the envelope. We've seen some things from them that are pretty interesting in terms of how they do social engineering and what they do once they get in. You know, I think the thing that we're most interested in seeing is when deepfakes really start to enter things like business email compromise and some of these other intrusions. That's when we're going to start. And we're already hearing about some things. There was some activity at the African Union, I think it was this year, and the election process over the course of this year, 42% of the Earth's population is going to be electing new leadership. There's 55 countries having general parliamentary or presidential elections this year. And I think we've already seen that deepfakes and some generative AI have played into that. And we're going to see more of that throughout the course of the year. And that, I think, is going to be what opens the floodgates from a criminal perspective.
Well, that's rosy. Thanks.
I wanted to end it on a happy note.
Yeah, no, that was, that's fantastic. You know, this has been a thing since I can remember in cyber is that, and before it was called that, right? In security in general is we build a better mousetrap, the mouse gets smarter. We build a better mousetrap, the mouse gets smarter. I think there's a third factor in this and that we're building a better mousetrap, but it's not just us versus the mouse. It's us versus the mouse with like the surrounding, you know, a bunch of cats walking around with tails. And you have to make sure that, you know, like the mousetrap doesn't accidentally take a cat's tail off by accident, right? So
Well, here's the good news. I think if you have threat hunting and you can apply cross-domain threat hunting, you've got a sniper pretty high up that can take out those mice.
Yeah, well, we should talk about that next time, because I don't, you know, there's a lot of companies that try to do that, DIY that, and it ends badly.
Yeah, well, so, I think there's benefits to doing it DIY and doing it internally, and you know, having something like our Overwatch threat hunting service that can kind of provide that additional level of comfort while you're developing those chops, because you do need to have local threat hunting as well as global threat hunting.
All right, Adam, this has been fun. James, I'm slightly less optimistic than I was before we started, and that wasn't much. Oh, well. All right, folks, thank you for listening. This has been another episode of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Catch us on LinkedIn. We have a page there. Go subscribe and get fresh episodes there and content. You can chat with us if you want to make suggestions or whatnot. I'm still got a Twitter/X feed, although I'm going to keep calling it Twitter until the URL and logo and everything changes. So it's Twitter. Screw you. come make me change it. And YouTube, of course, where we stream these things every once in a while, and you get to see Adam's face. Is like a floating head. If you're not watching this episode, you're missing it. Adam's literally just a floating head today. It's a little creepy, but it's funny. Thanks, Adam. Great having you on, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you guys another time, another place, on another Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Cue the music. We're out. See you later. Bye bye.
This is Bella. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave my dad a review and share this with your friends. Bye.